Okay, so I thank the organizer for having me here. There is very little sense in giving an introduction in this conference, so I'm going to skip it and only give you the necessary stuff. And I want to start actually from the home message of this talk. So as we all know, the biggest surprise of many-body localization can be actually summarized in one graph. And this, we saw this graph a lot of time, and this is the existence of a perfect insulator at a finite temperature. The surprise follows from the fact that all common insulators are only strictly insulators at zero temperature. What I'm going to discuss here is not this phase, but the ergodic phase. And in particular, I'm going to show you that for lattice systems in one and maybe even higher dimensions, the ergodic phase is not trivial either. And in the way it is not trivial, it is that the dynamics of it will show subdiffusive transport up to finite, but yet non-trivial at times. If one assumes that this behavior proceeds to asymptotic times, it will mean that DC conductivity will strictly vanish all over the place, and therefore the transition has to be changed from a metal insulator transition to a non-ergodic to ergodic transition with a broad subdiffusive phase in the ergodic phase. This means that DC conductivity is possibly not very sensitive to the transition, at least for those systems. And I will propose you a different metric by the end of the talk. So many-body localization can be observed in two settings. One setting is, of course, the laboratory. And there are two main things which can be done here. One is we will hear, I think all of the authors we will hear tomorrow, is called atom systems, which are isolated or close to isolated systems, and therefore are very suitable to study many-body localization. The other, I was happy that Kivelson gave an explanation of those kind of systems. I don't need to talk about that. And this is true condensed matter systems based on the idea of Basco, Linder, and Schuller. They're not, for some reason, represented in this conferences, but those guys also trying to observe many-body localization. Another setting, which is more appropriate for guys like me, is to conduct experiments in the office. And this, again, can be done in two ways. One way is to study infinite time properties. And here we can study a bunch of stuff that we already heard here. And I just want to mention that, as I said to you in the in the previous slide, vanishing DC conductivity, which was maybe the most the first thing you can think of infinite time properties, is most probably not sensitive for this transition, at least in these systems. Another thing that you can do is, instead of studying infinite time properties, you can study finite time properties. And for this, you can study dynamics, relaxation of observables. This is also discussed here. Since finite time properties are somehow more relevant to experiments, in particular to experiments in cold atoms, when after infinite time everything dies, then I will concentrate on finite type properties, mostly concentrate on finite time properties of the system. So, well, the existence of the non-ergodic phase is, as I said, the hallmark of many-body localization. Its dynamics is not particularly interesting because just there's no transport, just local relaxation. And on the other hand, as you will see, the ergodic phase shows quite interesting anomalous anomalous transport. In addition to that, and those properties are probably connected, the non-ergodic phase has area law of entanglement. It shows entanglement entropy which grows logarithmically in time. Well, the ergodic phase has a volume law and entanglement which grows faster than logarithmically. Those properties are connected probably also to another issue of simulability, and that the numerical study of the non-ergodic phase is quite easy, and there are many methods you can do, exact minimization, TDMRG, and strong disorder RG. But on the other hand, the study of the ergodic phase is very challenging and difficult. And we heard in the talk of Joel Moore discussion about that. And since I'm interested in the ergodic phase, I'm going to use a combination of approximate and exact methods to study the dynamics. So for this, we used the beaten to death in this conference model, which is, okay, I like to work in spinless fermions, but this is really just the XXZ model. And the nice thing about this model is that it has one state per side, namely bounded energy density, which allows us to study infinite temperature limits in a meaningful way. And this allows us to reduce the phase diagram to only two quantities, which is the disorder strength W and the interaction strength V. So to access the long-time dynamics and ergodic systems, what we do in the first place is utilize non-equilibrium diagrammatics technique. This is a technique which is, well, as we heard, was used by Bascoli and Aranciulli to establish the transition in the first place. The sketch of the technique is as following. One has one particle correlator function here. Then one writes exact equations of motions for those correlators which are written here. It includes one particle Hamiltonian, which can be time dependent, and includes all the interactions of the system are hidden in the self energies, which you normally don't know. So since you don't know the self energies, what you should do, you should make an approximation, and we are using essentially the approximation which was done in Bascoli and Aranciulli. The approximation is self-consistent, as I was saying in my previous remark. Namely, it includes an infinite summation of classes of diagrams, and therefore it can easily have monolithic corrections. And it includes two terms. One is the self-consistent Hartree Fock, and the other is the self-consistent second Bohr. And the only thing that I want to remark here is that if one tries to do this calculation only using self-consistent Hartree Fock, one gets garbage. One always gets localization, is because, you know, in Hartree Fock there is no possible relaxation mechanism. So these terms are crucial to have even a chance to see a method. So after obtaining the using the approximation of the self energies, this is the first approximation. What one does is one solves a set of integral differential equations. This is not as easy as it sounds. And after doing that, what you have to use, an initial condition. We use an uncorrelated pure one particle density matrix as the initial condition. The purity of the initial condition is crucial, and this was elucidated to us by Igor Lehner. And after doing that, what you can calculate is you can calculate in principle any one particle observable in the system. So what do we calculate? We calculate a density-density correlation function at infinite temperature, which is defined here. And this is basically, this quantity is basically an excitation of the density, and this is shown here. And we measure two things, the decay of the excitation designated by the time dependence of the blue dot, and the width of the excitation, which is just an analog of mean square displacement in classical physics. And well, those guys are defined here, blue and red. And for diffusion, of course, one has a decay of the density excitation like that in a generic dimension, and the mean square displacement grows linearly with time. And to have a little bit more sensitivity, what we define a dynamical exponent. This is a function which is a function of time, and it's just a logarithmic derivative of the mean square displacement, which has the property that the asymptotic value for diffusion, for example, is just 1. Good. So now we want to see how our approximation performs. And for this purpose, we compare it to exact denormalization. This comparison, well, in particular, I chosen to show you a comparison for a two-dimensional system, although I'm going to, in the next slide, return to one dimension. But here what is plotted is this decay of the density excitation, or the width, as a function of time. Black is exact denormalization. Red is the approximate method. And I didn't plot here, otherwise it will be cumbersome. Believe me, Hartree-Fock gives you complete nonsense. But what you can clearly see is that for larger disorder, this approximation becomes better and better, in the sense it works for longer and longer times. And in fact, one can convince himself that this approximation actually becomes asymptotically exact for a strong disorder. So this is nice. The same kind of graph works also in one dimension. Now what we can do with it? What we can do with it, we can access much larger system sizes, and we can practically, up to the simulated time, eliminate finite size effects altogether. So in all the following results, all the finite size effects up to this time were eliminated. So let's see the results. So what we do, we study, we obtain a phase diagram of the system based on the Bascoli and Schuller estimates. And we mostly study the ergodic phase. And we calculate what you see here is this decay of the density excitation as a function of time. And you can clearly see, with comparison to diffusion, that after those times, the transport is clearly subdiffusive. So OK, that's quite surprising, but maybe it's an artifact of the approximation. So let's compare it to some exact methods. So for exact methods, what we do, we start by mapping the phase diagram of the system using the ergodicity measure R, which was introduced first by Vadim and David in 2007, if I'm not mistaken, and now largely used in the literature. We follow the procedure. We obtain this phase diagram. Of course, one shouldn't take too seriously this boundary because of finite size effects. But nevertheless, the shape is like that. There are two interesting features in this phase diagram. One is that that there is a reentrance, which happens as a function of the interaction strength. So for strong, so you start here in a localized phase. For stronger interaction, become ergodic, and then you come back for even stronger interaction again to the non-ergodic phase. Another interesting feature is that there is a critical, disorder strength after which you are non-ergodic for any interaction strength. So now we want to contrast this phase diagram to the dynamical exponent, and this is done here. And what you firstly see is that, well, it's quite interesting because we use the completely different measures, but yet the form of the phase diagram has the same type, the same shape. It has both the reentrance and both the critical disorder strength. But what is more surprising is that if you look on the values here on this contour plot for the dynamical exponent, and there is a reminder here, is that you see that all those values are strictly less than 1 up to the considered time. So now, OK, so if we, again, stretch our finite time results to infinite times, then we, yes?
So I thought, do you add something to break integrality in the key limits that you expect to keep in the key limits?
I don't, but I tried also to break it, and doesn't change anything in an interesting way. Everything changes, of course, quantitatively. but nothing changes. So I tried to use the Vadim and David's model to break the integrability. It's very easy to do, but it doesn't change anything drastically. My numerical scheme breaks integrability? That's true. But I think what Sarang was asking is about the ED mostly. Yeah. So this is quite surprising. And again, here I need to move to a speculation, in the sense that if I increase this extend this conclusion for infinite time, DC conductivity is strictly zero. So this is quite surprising. And well, the reentrance actually already has support from both numerics, analytics, and experiments, which you will see in the talk of Uli. He's going to talk about that. I want to propose a new order parameter of the transition, since DC conductivity might be not a good thing to study. So what is a good order parameter? So like in any numerical or, in this sense, experimental setting, you cannot really observe a phase transition. You can only observe crossovers, and especially when you study such a small systems. So if I plot the dynamical exponent as an order parameter as a function of disorder strength, it just decreases to zero in a gradual way, and you cannot really establish a phase transition. So here comes a speculation, which is based on two facts. The first fact, which is the first fact, which is might be circumstantial, is that we see a difference in statistics between ergodic and non-ergodic phases. This is one, but this might be again due to finite size effects. The second fact, which is more I think strong, is that there is a proof actually that this phase exists. So if there's a proof that this phase exists, it means that alpha is strictly zero somewhere. And if alpha is strictly zero somewhere, then this function has to be non-analytic. And this is, well, this is the argument I use to show you that the transition can be described like that. How this non-analyticity behaves, I have no idea. But this is the sketch. And well, in subsequent studies, this idea got support both by Agarwal, Gopalakrishnan, in the Daimler group, and by RG studies, which are a completely different method, which practically gets the same type of idea. So, in the work of the Harvard group, there was a broad phenomenological explanation of the subdiffusion. Practically what they do, they are inspired by the works of Shlomo Alexander in the 80s and well, many other people. And they make a parallel to a random barrier or random resistor network in one dimension. And basically, well, David Hughes explained us about that, so I don't have to repeat much. But what it says that in one dimension, when a particle travels on a line, it has to encounter all the barriers on the way. He cannot avoid them if you want to escape on the other side. And therefore, even exponentially rare barriers are important. And if one does the calculation, one can get a subdiffusion. Now, what happens in two dimensions? If one stretches this analogy to two dimensions, what gets a situation of a drunken downtown? So a drunken downtown travels, but he doesn't have to hit every skyscraper in the way because he can avoid them. That's much simpler, right? So all these theories of random barriers predict asymptotic diffusion. Moreover, in RG calculations and phenomenological RG calculations, one also constructs a percolating cluster, but the percolating cluster is ergodic, so one also gets asymptotic diffusion at the end. So we wanted to see what happens not in an asymptotic regime, but for finite times. Okay, because again, in experiments, no one is going to study asymptotics. So for finite times, what we chose to study in two dimensions is the Anderson-Hubbert model. And well, this is the model. This is the analog of this density excitation. And you see how this density excitation propagates in time. This is a real data for a 30 by 30 system and W equal to 5. And what the reason I showed you that is not to show that I can do a three-dimensional plot, but to show you that there is no finite size effects in the simulation. So now we can repeat exactly the same game. We choose our phase. We take the phase diagram based again by estimates, either by Rosen's CARDQ or the Basqualainer. It doesn't matter. It gives almost the same result. And then we make a cut, which is mostly in the ergodic phase. And now we see how the dynamical exponent behaves as a function of time. And surprisingly, well, the times here are not extremely long, but they're 50. They're of definite relevance to cold atoms experiments, as you will see tomorrow. You see that this dynamical exponent looks like it saturates, and it's, well, it's below the diffusion line. So we cannot say anything about the asymptotics, and hopefully this can be answered more carefully in experiment. And one thing which was in experiment, it's hard to do this this density excitation of one electron because of signal to noise ratio. So what in David Hughes was proposing me in a private communication, that instead of doing a small excitation, you can do large excitation. And the large excitation that you can do is to have like a density profile here. And instead of calculating the mean square displacement, just calculating how much mass is transferred to the left or from the right as a function of time. So now I can do this. And well, one gets exactly the same result, is that the mass on the left-hand side is a function of time, shows clear subdiffusive behavior up to those studied time. Those are just the parameter I used. And here in the inset, you see the density profile as a function of time, the initial density profile, and the final density profile. And again, you see that there's no finite size effect in this simulation. So this is what we have. And now I want to try to compare this to phenomenological models. And I want to compare the two phenomenological models. One is diffusion on a percolation cluster using bond percolation. And so I compute the dynamical exponent as a function of time. This is how it looks. And the other is the random resistor network in two dimensions. Again, compute the dynamical exponent and see how it looks. So you see that the random resistor network, if the network is sparse enough, so in principle, it can have subdiffusive transport, which is consistent with our data. On the other hand, on the percolation here, it looks like those guys resemble our data, but there is one problem, that this region is below the percolation threshold and therefore is by definition non-ergodic. I'm studying the ergodic phase. Therefore, I think that this is not very consistent with our data. Here or here? Here the sparsity of the network. So it's the equivalent of the disorder strand. So now I want to entertain a different possible resolution of this subdiffusion. So since the corresponding classical systems, and this was shown in Paolo Ganesian and Hughes, I don't remember the year, but they showed that for classical systems, if one tries to do this, you get diffusion at the end. Okay, so we get subdiffusion, and this was confirmed both by exact dualization and RG. So let's suppose that it's correct. That means that the subdiffusion is a quantum effect. We have two possible quantum effects. One, which I proposed in the previous slide, is tunneling, and this is random. It has to do with random barriers. But there is another effect which people don't discuss in the community, and this is interference. So I want to entertain this thought, And if I show a graph of a typical graph of the XXZ model, it looks something like that. And what one have to remember is that the graph, although people want like to approximate it, is not a tree. And the reason it's not a tree is because there are loops. Okay, so if there are loops, it means that unlike the beta lattice where there is no weak localization corrections, here, in principle, weak localization corrections are possible. What are the problems? The problem is that if one looks on regular lattices, then weak localization, this I think Joel Moore mentioned, weak localization corrections are normally connected to return probabilities. This is why they diverge in one and two dimension. But for higher dimension, what one has is that the return probability is a monotonically decreasing function of a dimension. For fog graphs, which are shown here, I am not aware of calculations of return probabilities, but one can easily convince himself or herself is that the return probability is at least bounded from below by 1 over V, where V is the volume. That's the last slide. So while this is not a big number, one has to remember that weak localization corrections, when there is no dephasing mechanisms, are always studied in a finite system size. Therefore, for any finite system size, this return probability is a finite number. Now, I don't have any analytical arguments to support this conjecture, but I propose a way how to study this procedurally. So how to differentiate between tunneling and interference? And this can be done by using semi-classical techniques. In semi-classical techniques, which based on classical trajectories, one cannot recover tunneling because they're based on classical trajectories, but one can recover interference. Therefore, if one does a semi-classical calculation of this model and sees subdiffusion, one knows that this subdiffusion is a result of interference. This is what I'm trying to do right now. So just to summarize, we found an ergodic phase which is subdiffusive for non-trivial times in 1D and 2D. We proposed a dynamical exponent as the order parameter of this transition, and we found a reentrant localization for strong interaction, which says that interaction does not necessarily counter the disorder, but sometimes it works with it. This, in fact, was proposed by Anderson in some paper. Well, and what's next? I'm just going to flash you because I'm over time. Yeah, let's leave it open. I'm up for questions.
I was just wondering about this suggestion of interference being important. Since entanglement propagates faster than any transport quantity, and since you're thermal on this ETH side of the transition, do you really think you can have coherent quantum effects in transport?
Well, I think it's, I don't know. The answer I don't know, but I would like to think it's possible because there are still loops. So the question is whether those loops are important or not. I don't think it's such a trivial, there is a trivial answer for that. Moreover, there is a recent study of the propagation of entanglement entropy, which says that actually on the ergodic phase, the entanglement entropy propagates subdiffusively.
But always faster than the transport.
Yes, it always faster than the transport.
I have a question actually regarding the first part of your talk in which you use the self-consistent equation for the self-energy.
Yeah.
If I understand correctly, in Bascolen and Schuler, that's used, that self-consistent Born approximation is used for the localized phase because it's there that converges.
So actually it was used for both phases.
Also to correct, to find the corrections for the, okay.
So I'm not sure I understand the distinction at tunneling versus interference because, so if I think of the subdiffusive phase as I think most of us think about it as inclusions of the insulator inside the conductor. And
yeah.
These inclusions, the fact that you have an insulator there is actually an interference effect, right? The fact that you have a discrete spectrum that gives you an for some time scale it gives you insulating behavior. If you put these inclusions independently of they would act like an insulator, I guess.
Well, I don't completely agree with this.
I think the random resistor
model is a tunneling model by definition. So it's based on tunneling rates. There's no, and in fact, if you look on that, so this is a question of hopping
that's
conductivity.
That's why I don't understand the distinction. I think the tunneling rate is a coarse grained quantity after in the you've solved the quantum mechanical problem for the short scales, which
yes.
involves interference, and that gives you the long time scale for what you call tunneling. In the long scale,
I agree.
I think it's a classical model, but its parameters are derived by solving a quantum problem on a shorter length scale, which involves interference as a fundamental.
But
part
to have a barrier, you don't have to be quantum, right? You can be classical.
I agree that there are classical models with subdiffusion, but in this case, the subdiffusion, the fact that the tunneling is distributed in that way is due to a quantum underlying quantum effect, but I think it's maybe just a matter of words what you call tunneling and what you call having no resonance corresponds to having a discrete spectrum. If you don't have a discrete spectrum, you don't have to talk about resonant or non-resonant, and the fact that you have to think about tunneling through some region is because you have a discrete spectrum there.
Well, procedurally, what I mean is, well, it's very well defined. So let's suppose you want to calculate a weak localization correction of a beta lattice, you don't get it, right? But on the other hand, you get localization. So two different things. So here, I mean, what I want to do is to calculate, well, analytically what I would do is to calculate the weak localization correction, but this might be difficult. So I propose a more easier approach.
A little bit, so maybe for the sake of making it to the reception afterwards, we should move on. Let's thank the speaker once again.